Good day and good evening, my friends, wherever you might be, and welcome to Red Ice Radio. This is Henrik Palmgren, your host, coming to you live from the very warm west coast of Sweden. I hope you're all are feeling well and that you are ready, because we have a great program for you today. As I hope most of you know, we have Michael Sarion with us today, and I also hope that you have been checking my site, red-ice.net, during the week, and that you know that we'll be doing a six-part series with Michael right here on bbsradio.com. And this is our first program in this series, and we'll also be having a contest during each of these shows. And today you will have the opportunity to win the first program from Michael Sarion's DVD series, Origins and Oracles. And this first program is called Atlantis, Alien Visitation and Genetic Manipulation. And it's a 5-DVD set, simply jam-packed with Michael's wonderful research material. And it is oriented around his first book with the same name. And Michael has been preparing questions for today's program, so I hope that we have some you know, folks out there who are listening live and ready to call and brave enough to talk to us here. So we'll be giving out that question, you know, about 30 minutes into this show or something, so stay tuned. And the rules are very, very simple. You know, the first person to call us with a correct answer will win the DVD. So we can give out the phone number right here at the start, so you'll be ready when time comes. And it's a toll-free number. You simply call 1-877-876-5227. Again, that's 1-877-876-5227. Or you can drive 530-876-3222, and we'll be giving out those numbers again later on, so no worries if you missed it. And you can always find the numbers right on the front page of bbsradio.com, or if you follow the link to the contest page from my site also. And okay, now let's not forget that we also have a great program lined up for you today, and it's always an honor and a pleasure to speak with Michael Sarion, and he always has an ability to dive right into the most interesting areas of his research, and I have been looking forward to kick off this program series very much. So hello, Michael, and welcome back to the program, and thank you for, you know, spoiling us yet again with another appearance on Red Ice Radio.
Hey, son. Henrik, I'm glad that we're able to, you know, spend time again together with these great subjects and do justice to them with some, you know, lengthier time with a series. That's a really phenomenal opportunity, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and it's, you know, it's great to have you here, and thank you for taking the time to do this. And I think it's going to be great also. And you know, how are things over there in the U.S. or in, you're in Washington, right?
At the moment, yes, I'm in Washington State.
Yeah, okay. Are you having a hot time over there too?
Well, yeah, we're, you know, the latest news about the Bin Laden, the whole concept that, you know, he's been found dead, or the rumor
is that
you know, he's
Tell me about this. I haven't heard.
Yeah, there's the rumor that Bin Laden may be in fact dead. You know, a while ago, from ill health, is the latest the sort of rumor going around. So we've been looking into that. It's kind of interesting, because that would be the perfect cop-out, because, of course, we understand that the government forces cannot continue searching for him and spending all that money. Mm-hmm. And why would they really want to be searching to discover or to find and to bring to justice a guy that they've been paying all along in the beginning? Mm-hmm. Because anybody who's followed my work and David Icke's work know that the Carlyle Group has already been funding, you know, Bin Laden is a key member of the old Carlyle Group, and has been funded by America. So yeah, we can hardly understand that American forces are going to want to bring their own guy to ever bring him to justice. But on the other hand, the search for bin Laden can't go on indefinitely, obviously. So there has to be some sort of resolution. So what would be better, what would be the perfect ruse than to say, oh my goodness, guess what? They kept it from us. He died of ill health, you know, months ago. And, you know, Al-Qaeda didn't tell us about it. And now our research is telling us, you know, Pakistani intelligence, the guy is dead. So we can kind of basically scale back the operation. So America comes out with a good face, the American government comes out with a, you know, a good face, and they can sort of scale back on the investigation and never have to bring the guy to justice so that people ask a bunch of, you know, difficult questions.
Hmm.
Very strange scenario.
Yeah, and this is this a mainstream press reporting on this?
It was, I think so, yeah.
Okay, all right. Hmm, very interesting.
It's been going around on the Internet. When people realize just how the you know these secret forces work, basically when we realize how concocted everything is, and that almost without fail, you know, be it the Bader Meinhof or the PLO or the IRA or Saddam Hussein, you know, the famous nemesis that are always created and put up in front of us, these are bogeymen. You know, when we finally understand how the game works. I think, wasn't it on a show recently, one of our last shows, where we spoke about that a little bit, about how the research into secret societies and subversive movements and into alternative history is pretty much a very recent thing?
Yeah, we did, yeah.
Yeah, and see, we still haven't really got it. You know, our attention has been on so many different things. We have accepted, our forefathers at least have accepted official reports for everything that's ever happened. So, you know, it's only in very recent times, and that's why there is still a lot of knee-jerk reaction from people when you bring out the points of the dialectic and how the secret societies operate. It's because it's still a bitter pill to swallow, because it's kind of a new kind of research. It really does date from within a 30 to 50 year period where serious questions have started to be asked about the alternative history of the world. So, you know, still people have to catch on to what's going on.
Yeah, of course, absolutely. It feels like it's an almost like a collective awakening process to much of the information, and of course, internet makes this available to us, and through the work, the kind of work that you do, and of course, but I mean, I know that you base a lot of your research material on you research other people who have researched, sort of.
Oh yeah.
This information got to come from somewhere. I mean, can we trust all the sources, so to speak?
Anything. You have to treat it like any course of study. You have to treat it reverently and diligently, and you have to address this kind of subject matter in exactly the same way that you address going to night school or taking a university class, you see, any kind of course. Well, you have to be serious about it. I mean, we are serious about the ordinary courses that we take because we know they're going to get us a job, you know, for some pragmatic reason. We will take an orientation at work. We will go on a training course or whatever. We'll take night classes, and we'll spend our money. We'll pay our time. You know, we'll spend our time, and we will listen to the teacher, and we will also absorb a lot of false information. But what we will do is we will give our energy and our time, and it's no different with these subjects. They must be treated reverently, and therefore you have to use your discrimination and do your homework to be able to discover through simple research and through simple discernment who is right. There's no way that, you know, I could have written any of my books. I've always said that without William Bramley, without Jack Barringer and without Jordan Maxwell, the Atlantis book that I wrote could never probably have come into existence, at least in the form that it is. And certainly without people like Jim Fitzpatrick, the great Irish artist that started me off in this subject way back in 1980 or 1979.
Mm.
Without people like Ahmed Osman and Mustafa Gadali, you see, and Ralph Ellis, the Irish Origins of Civilization book and my work on that subject could never be done. And I'm very open about the people that have inspired me in times before. That's very, very key to always remember the ones who have gone before us. And you're talking about America in American context. Yeah, there is a sort of an awakening coming, because we now have people like Alex Jones coming out of the mainstream, you see, coming out to a very mainstream audience and trying to wake people up. you know? Yeah. And there's been in the past people like Eustace Mullins and Gary Allen, the senator here, yeah. And you've had Charles Lindbergh Sr., you see? So you've had a lot of people. Now, other than Eustace Mullins, the people before, in the, say, the early turn of the century or maybe up through the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, in America, didn't make a career as alternative historians. They were either politicians, you see, or clergymen, or they had some other kind of job. There was businessmen, perhaps, like Henry Ford or whatever. And they may have spoken briefly about the world conspiracy. It's not that they made their whole livelihood at it. We have to wait until we come up almost to the people like Gary Allen and like Eustace Mullins, who actually sat down and wrote books on it, who literally sat down and wrote physically on it, before we can really say that the culture has begun, where individuals are literally questioning what the symbolism in government means, you see,
yeah,
and what the agendas might be behind the scenes. This is so phenomenally recent, and I think we mentioned this before, that people need to be realized that this is a new subject. There has been no campaign of coherent, proactive opposition against the world conspiracy or the world order. That opposition begins now.
Yeah.
I say this in the DVDs, you know, at the end of the DVDs when we're doing the solution parts of the scenario.
Yeah, yeah.
We have to be absolutely convinced, not be pessimistic, say, oh my goodness, how could this all happen? You know, well, how could it happen that the mafia got created with a stroke of the pen when the American government signed in prohibition? Instantly, the mafia and other groups like them, were the seed was planted. Groups that never could have existed before, instantly became powerful overnight by a single law called prohibition, which, by the way, was meant to be in a free country. But the so-called free country is not going to tell you that you can drink alcohol or not. You know. So when we talk to American audiences, we've got to remind them: tell me, please, what is free about your country. Because you not only had, you know, prohibition, which basically told you what you could and could not drink in this country, my goodness, but then out of that edict, out of that law that was passed, against your will, against your say-so, came some of the most pernicious mafioso-type societies in the world.
Yeah.
And they ruled here for a long, long time and have basically, you know, still in power, many of them. So.
And it feels that the only difference between, if we are to draw these parallels, of course, between us and them, is that they are the ones who just, you know, they just set out and do it. They just, you know, perform these acts right in front of our face, and as long as we don't say anything, you know, they can go ahead.
That's right. And it was, you know, that's a matter of scale. If a mafia can be created like that, from a government edict, and people can accept that, why can they not accept that further up the pyramid, you see? And the reason why they cannot is because, one, and we must never forget this, it is a very recent form of study. But people in this world take things in tremendously for granted.
Yeah.
If a thing is out for 5 minutes, they're already bored. In this subject, we have to understand, no, this is so new, and that you are a part of a privileged generation to have the websites, to have, you know, the speakers, even on radio.
Yeah.
If you hear anybody exposing this, to hold a book by, you know, Eustace Mullins or any of these great teachers in your hand, or by even if we want to go back in Britain, it did happen earlier at the turn of the century with Nesta Webster, you see, and a whole bunch of other people in a European context. But in an American context, it's extremely new, as well as new in a European context. And therefore, we must never take it for granted. So, yeah, all the answers are not in yet, but we're doing a great job discovering what is really going on, you know, behind the veil of the silence and the veil of national security and so on.
Yeah. And, do you think that this is, if we are to tie this to the church, I mean, which, after all, has dominated our world for,
right.
I don't know, 1,500 years or so, maybe more, and the church in the form that it is now, of course. But, it is fairly recent also, I think, that not that the power of the church has left, but it has shifted towards other things. And now the possibility has now opened up to, you know, even be allowed to study things. And you know, how Do you think that the church has this powerful role to play here? So
absolutely. You know, in my work, I'm always talking about the Atonists and the cult of Aton and the worship of the dark side of the sun and the dark side of light. To me, that's what Vatican is. The word Vatican, by the way, which again, we're not insulting Roman Catholics here. We're not talking about a person following a religion. The religion of Catholicism, as followed by an ordinary person, is not what we're talking about. We're talking about the institution known as the Vatican. And the word Vatican or Vaticanus means place of divination or place of sorcery, implying that these individuals use magic and use divination. And anyone whose eyes are open, who goes even as a tourist to Rome and looks at the symbolism there, the 13 famous obelisks and the work of Gian Lorenzo Bernini and many of the other great artists and all the occult symbolism there, the skulls and bones that are almost on every corner, one can see that there's something ritualistic in nature going on. They have to open their eyes a little bit and see behind the veil of why is it that the Pope, for instance, wears the yarmulke on his head, and why does he wear, you know, why has the Pope's been seen wearing the symbols of what looks like the breastplate, the Urim and Thummim of the Hebrews, the Jews, the 12 breastplates of all of the symbolism that's there. And you're right. What we're calling the Vatican there is a hybrid. It has hybridized many different organizations that come under its power. It has many tentacles. It has many lieutenants. So that if you chop off one arm, you see, it grows it back. It has so many. In fact, the whole of Protestantism is nothing but a creation of the Vatican.
Yeah.
The whole of the New Age movement, by the way, is a creation of the Vatican. The American government is controlled by agents of the Vatican.
And I'm sorry to interrupt, Michael, but for anyone who doubts this, why do you think that they, you know, what, if I, just to, you know, ask a rhetorical question here, why would they create something that, on the surface at least, is against the Vatican?
Well, you see, this is done because it's very important on the surface to appear that you have a rival. The world controllers create their own rivals. They're called foe rivals. It's just the same as the old conflicts that you find in any country of the world. It's the same idea that warring factions are funded by the same hidden hand, which is a fact that has come out. It's the same thing. If you don't create, it's like a chess game. If you don't create your own nemesis, then you have the problem of having the real nemesis come and fight you. So what you do is you create a foe enemy, because in doing that, you're in control of the enemy. It's like a rigged fight. It's like a rigged boxing match.
Yeah.
Because if you don't, then you might have, you know, a giant come out to fight you who you haven't funded, and they can't afford that.
Yeah.
When we realize the incredible power of this group and the intelligence and the almost the strategical power is to realize that they want to wipe out their legitimate opposition, but then they create their own opposition. And this is what is going on in politics all over the world. And the people are basically brainless enough to accept this, and therefore nothing changes.
Yeah.
Nothing at all changes. Just a few more, you know, so-called privileges are thrown our way for which we have to pay in blood.
Yeah.
Until we wake up to realize a very simple fact, and that is both sides of the political spectrum are funded by the same hidden hand. Their symbolism tells you that. And it's the same thing up the ladder. So in wars and in political strategies and even in larger political theological conflicts, it is extremely healthy to, their idea is to create a faux nemesis so that you don't have the real thing ever rise up, because people will identify with the faux enemy and therefore nothing will ever change. It's a very, very good strategy. And you know, my entire work is prompted by my concern about this, because I'm Irish and I'm fully aware, unlike most Irish people, of who has desecrated that country in ages past. The book Irish Origins of Civilization is not just some, you know, some book I'm throwing together because I really have nothing better to do. This is part of a, you know, 20-year research to discover the travesty of why there has been death and mayhem and murder and desecration in that country from the time of the Christianity got there onwards, and how who it is that has obscured the true religion, the true solar, stellar church in that country, that most people will live and die in Ireland and not understand the beauty and the majesty of that country. And when I talk about Ireland, I am including here Scotland, and I'm also including Scandinavia, because this old Scots-Irish Druidic tradition extended from the north of Scotland in Argyllshire. You know, most of the Celtic people, the pure Celts, lived in Scotland, Ireland, and also were very prominent in Scandinavia, because round towers of a Celtic design, you see, have been discovered there. So this tradition that we're talking about, that very few people have ever touched upon, is not there anymore. It was wiped off the face of the earth. The whole Druidic order, as we said in one of the other programs, the word Irish was not ever spelt with an I. That was a little bit later. And the word IR, like in Irish, means the sacred. Ir means sacred. But before that, it was actually pronounced AR, Irish, or Aria, the Aria, the Aryans. So the understanding is that the true Aryans hasn't really much to do with ethnicity or even race. It has to do with theocratic standing and status.
Exactly.
Because we talked about the falsity of this idea that there's been a movement of history. Remember, the great taboo subject is you never, ever question you never question religion, and you never question that the elements of civilization moved from the east to the west. Well, that's exactly what my work does question, and it's time for the alternative historians to really, really understand this and to follow in line with the great scholars like Commons Beaumont and Conor McDarry to absolutely make understood that it was the Irish civilization coming out of Ireland, the descendants of Atlantis, who brought the elements of culture into the lands of the west and into the lands of the east, finally. And that there was Druidic colleges, Druidic stellar solar churches that spread out from Ireland and England. In those days, it was Britain, out into Scandinavia and down through all the other cultures of the world. Now, this has been thoroughly covered up.
Yeah.
So when any Eastern, you know, peoples are telling you about the Aria and the famous one, the noble ones, in exactly the same way as the South American Mexicans and the South American Indians will tell you that they were visited by the Pahona, the great white brothers, you see. You know, the Hopi Indians even mention it. Well, it's the same thing in the East. How can you be told in Americas that the civilization, the great ones, the great medics, and the great healers and the great teachers were coming from the East, but then you come to the Eastern Europe and they're telling you they did it? There's a missing link here.
It doesn't. And we said that we would talk a little bit about the characters in the Bible today and how it has been
That's right.
Concocted as a cover for this cult of Aton. And I mean, just as you say there, I know that I have myself read a few articles that are have the undercurrent and suggest that people like Abraham came from Eastern Oriental countries or Hindu origins, do you think this is entirely wrong here?
They've barely got further than underwriting the same old story that has been handed down to us by the Vatican. In 2,000 years, barely nothing has changed. There's been a little speculation based on the etymology, but people just don't draw the strong enough conclusions. And it doesn't matter, though, because these conclusions were already drawn at the turn of the century by the great Conor McDarry. You see, we have always gone backwards when it comes to scholarship. The great authors that wrote on the Irish origins of civilization have already written on a lot of this.
Yeah.
And their work has been suppressed. If we don't know truth, it's because it has been, ground to the dirt. We have scholars like Gerald Massey and Commons Beaumont and Conor McDarry and Anna Wilkes, the people that I follow in the footsteps of, that I mentioned on the website and in the forthcoming book, who've already talked about all of this. And that Abraham, his father, for instance, Abraham's father was Terah, T-E-R-A-H, which is very close to the Irish Celtic Tara. So if anything, if one really wanted to draw some major conclusions, there's equal evidence for saying that he had Celtic ancestry than anything else. But the actual fact of the matter is that the patriarch Abraham, in exactly the same way as his descendants, Jacob, Isaac, and Joseph, and these individuals, what the sum of my work regarding this is that, no, they were not in any sense, wanderers out of Canaan who just happened to turn up in Egypt. But that these individuals were themselves a very powerful pharaonic dynasty that had arrived in Egypt in the 13th dynasty. This is about 1700 years B.C. And the group that I'm talking about was known as the Hyksos people, H-Y-K-S-O-S. And this word Hyksos was deliberately misinterpreted by Egyptologists and people who studied Egypt for many, many years, for many decades. And so the Hyksos was never paid any mind until more recently with the work of Mustafa Gadala and Ahmed Osman, and also a man called Ralph Ellis, the English writer Ralph Ellis, who have cracked the code. And basically, it's amazing too, because the first person, one of the early people who actually tried to expose a lot of this, was actually the great Sigmund Freud, believe it or not.
Mm.
Yeah, the German psychologist. One of his last books, written in 1930, I think, was a book that talked about Moses, trying to prove that Moses and Akhenaten were the same person.
Yeah.
Yeah. So again, you know, we have this information. And do you know that the great Emmanuel Velikovsky, another one of the great, probably the most suppressed scholar of all time, he also wrote a book on Moses and the Akhenaten concept. So there has been books and literature out there that have totally refuted the official stories that were told about these patriarchs of Judaism, the patriarchs of Islam, because don't forget that Abraham is considered the patriarch of Christianity, Judaism, and Islam.
Yes.
So we are dealing with something very powerful here, and the ignorance factor is very, very high. People have just taken on faith a certain amount of stuff. Now, the Abraham, in short, just to answer your question, turns out to be a pharaoh from the Hyksos dynasty that lived in the northwest part of the Delta region in Egypt and was an extremely wealthy and very powerful pharaonic individual with a court and with his own dynasty, with his own coterie. And it has now come to light through the work of these authors that I'm mentioning that there were these, what are known as Israelite pharaohs of Egypt.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this is later on, in order to hide and disguise this, that the Bible, which is nothing but a book of Freemasonry, the Bible is nothing but a pharaoh's book. It's a book about pharaohs, written by pharaohs originally, because they say that Moses is the writer or author of the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch, the Torah. Well, listen up. If it can be proven, as the great Sigmund Freud was stating, and as Emmanuel Velikovsky and as other writers, and now as I am working on to fill in the details, to sort of give the restoring the freeze to bring the colors more into vividness and to explain in a modern context. If it turns out that Moses was in fact Akhenaten, one of the most powerful pharaohs who ever lived, then we got to understand once and for all that there's nothing Judaic about the Bible. The Bible is a book of the pharaohs, written by the pharaohs, and later edited, tweaked, skewed by the Francis Bacons, you see, and the Josephuses and the other editors who wrote on the Bible, were merely fixing it and hiding it and concealing it and changing it, because there's been hundreds of translations even of just one single passage. So we must understand that when we pick up a Bible today from the table, it is certainly not the Bible of the ancient world. There are so many translations. But that, you know, from day one, what we have to understand when it comes to the questioning of all of this, is that we have from the writings of the great leaders of the secret societies themselves and their commenters. So I don't care if it's Madame Blavatsky or if it's Giuseppe Mazzini of the Illuminati or Albert Pike or if it comes from the Duke of Brunswick. We have writings from, or George Washington, we have from their own writings statements that say, we are not the head. We are subservient to forces that are unseen that operate above us. So my interest, especially inspired by people like Jordan Maxwell and so on, has been to discover who and what are these people that they're talking about. Let's discover what this is. With one hand, I'm very concerned about who desecrated my country and brought it to the state of misery and spiritual ruin that it is in, this great solar church. I've always wanted to answer that question because I know what went on there came from Atlantis, and I'm fully aware of the power of that place, of Ireland. And at the other hand, I'm thinking about, well, who is this, you know, overarching dominion that rules the other agents of the secret societies? Well, and then I discovered, like I'm also trying to teach people now, is that the symbolism tells you. And the Egyptian symbolism stares out, does it not? The symbolism of these secret societies and the power that's above them is Egyptian in origin. And this should never be overlooked.
Exactly. And what do you say, Michael? Should we, take a little break? We're at the bottom of the hour, and maybe we should, do our little contest here.
So. Well, yeah, I think the first question that I was thinking about is a very simple one. It's on my website. We'll have to avoid mentioning it today on our show, just in case it comes up in conversation. But the question is, We're talking a lot about Egypt, and we're talking about the great pharaoh Akhenaten. And of course, we know that the wife of Akhenaten, most people who studied Egypt a little bit know that she was the wonderful, famous, beautiful Nefertiti. But my question to people in the contest is, can you call in and tell us who was the mother of Nefertiti? So that's the question for today. Who was the mother of Nefertiti? And the first person who gets that answer correct will be able to pick the DVD of their choice, or they can have the Atlantis, the first, as you say, the first DVD.
Yeah, of course, we can do any way we want to do it here. So
keep it really open, and the questions are going to be real simple. We just want people to encourage to get into this information.
Exactly. And let me again give out the details for anyone calling in here. You can call toll-free 1-877-876-5227. Again, that's 1-877-876-5227. And of course, make sure to leave your address to don@bbsradio.com before you come on, so we can send you the DVD, and also we'll announce the winners on red-ice.net, and maybe also on your on Michael's blog, I don't know, and simply go to Michael's site, which is www.taroscopes.com, to find the appropriate links to you know, his blog and all the things that we are discussing here today.
People can go to michaeltesarian.com. It's an easy way to see all the different websites that I have.
Yeah, of course,
if they just go to michaeltesarian.com, they can do that. And, yeah, absolutely remember to leave your exact address so that we can get the item off to you.
Yeah, of course.
Now, you know, there's one. If we have a moment, there's one thing. Because in this first show, it's good to set the overview of where we're going.
Yeah.
We have to realize something very important about these controllers. The Illuminati, let's get this one thing really clear in context of the Vatican. The Illuminati was created and founded, or at least officially founded, by the guy, Adam Weishaupt. Adam Weishaupt was a Jesuit priest, and he never left that order, nor did he refute it in his life.
Yeah.
So right there, we have to discover something very bizarre. When we go to the earliest writings of the founder of Protestantism, Martin Luther, we see Rosicrucian symbolism on the front cover of the books. So we've got questions. And we have questions as to why it is that the Catholic Church at that time, the Vatican, who annihilated people by sword and by flame, who indulged themselves in a 100 years war of total slaughter throughout Europe, who indulged themselves in a 30-year war of total slaughter throughout Europe, that all historians know, and who were the most intolerant, barbarous popes on existence, who slaughtered and murdered in wars from the time of their inception, why is it that they would allow a single man to go up and nail onto one of their chapel doors a petition of the 50 edicts of change, and just let the guy sort of wander through Europe free? I got a question why that would be. If they didn't like you, they'd hung, draw, and quarter you, okay? They put a nail through the tongue of Giordano Bruno, one of the greatest scholars that have ever graced this planet. They took him down to the center of the square and burned him at the stake and put a nail through the guy's tongue. That's how they deal with people who are against them.
Hmm.
Now, Martin Luther was no Giordano Bruno, not even close. So then you tell me why Luther and Wesley and Knox and Calvin, John Calvin, whose real name actually was John Cohen, he was of Jewish extraction, and Adam Weishaupt and these people were allowed to move towards Protestantism and allowed to do what they do. There's a very simple reason for that. Now, coming to the Illuminati itself, once we understand firmly that the Illuminati is a Vatican agent, a lieutenant operating in the world with a specific agenda, and the reason is, very briefly, is because Catholicism knew at the time of the creation of the Illuminati and at the time of the creation of Protestantism that it was losing favor throughout the world, and that the princes and the dukes and the royalty of the world were getting very fed up with it, with the way that bishops were running things and the corruption of the church, and they knew that they might have a rival. That rival might be paganism arising again, you see, and they knew that they may be rivaled very seriously, and this was a deep concern for them. So like we said in the early part of the program, they created their own opposition.
to catch the same fish in the net, just in case anyone would branch away. They'll create the branch to which people will walk.
Exactly.
Because there's, as Jordan Maxwell has said so many times, there's not an ounce of difference in the symbolism or the teachings, really, between Judaism, Catholicism, and Protestantism. It's merely shades of the same color. Now, here's the interesting thing about the Illuminati that I want to establish.
Yeah.
Because it was something that I looked at very deeply, because everyone knows about the famous degrees of Freemasonry and the 33rd degree, and there's speculation, of course, that there's 74 degrees, you know, everything goes on further. But let's understand one thing. If anyone picks up a book on the Illuminati and looks at the Illuminati, they have the famous 8 degrees. And the reason why they have 8 is because they're solar in nature. 8 is the famous number of the sun, like the old pirates, pieces of 8. It used to be gold coins because gold is like the sun, and they're called pieces of 8. 8 has always been connected to the sun. You only have to go and look at a Shell station today. When you look at a Shell station, you see the symbol of the shell, and you understand that that is really the symbol of the rising sun. Not a shell. It's a sun with 8 rays on a red background, just like the dawn in the morning when the sun rises on the eastern horizon. That's the symbol that you're seeing on a Shell gas station, because that's Dutch Royal Shell, controlled by British monarchy. And their symbol is an 8-rayed sun beam, because 8 is very important to these people. You know, and the 8th panel, there's 8 solar panels on the window above 10 Downing Street and so on. But the interesting thing is that in the Illuminati 8 degrees, the 4th degree, Henrik, is Freemason. Okay, so we're only halfway up the scale, and then they say that the degree of the Illuminati includes the Freemason. When you go up to the very top, the supreme degree of mastery in the Illuminati was called Rex, R-E-X.
Yeah.
And many scholars know this. Many people have seen this chart. You can get online, and you can see this, you know, why have never anybody questioned what that word means? The word Rex in anybody's, you know, dictionary means king, does it not?
Yeah.
So why is it that the chief Freemasonic motto throughout the world, which is also found on courts and other places, is Per me regnus regnant, through me kings will reign. And then we find that the word king is at the top of the Freemasonic, not the Freemasonic degrees, but the Illuminati degrees. This is a super secret order. Their own highest rank is Rex, the king. What king? Now, who would this king be?
Yeah.
And why even use the term king of all of them in the king? Oh, I thought this was meant to be some sort of Protestant organization. You see? Who didn't kind of go in for all of that stuff. But no, we find that there's royal symbols, crowns, crosses and crowns.
Yeah.
It's there's not a Masonic symbol that you can see, whether it's the cross and the crown or the Masonic double-headed eagle, that doesn't have the crown at the top of it.
Yeah.
State heraldry and so on. I am here to tell people who that crown belongs to. It was Akhenaten. And my work verges away from the other writers on this subject of the 18th dynasty, because I do not believe, I do not lionize this character, and do not believe he was the great sort of proto-Christ.
Yeah.
The good guy before Jesus came on the scene, who tried to get it right and tried to get all those, you know, devil-worshipping pagans into line and create the first monotheism. What a guy. No, the story of the man's desecration and heresy is unrivaled in the world. So I'm one of the few scholars, I'm only one of two that I can actually think of in the modern age, who is actually, you know, not lionizing Akhenaten, because as brilliant as the work of Ahmed Osman is, and as brilliant as the work of Akhenaten, of Mustafa Gadala is, and even as brilliant as the work of Ralph Ellis is, the problem that differs me from these authors is that they are dribbling and slobbering over this Akhenaten still. And even other great authors like you know, Richard Darlow comes to mind, who is more of the official line, you see. All of the official people. There's all the official people who speak about official Egyptology, including some of the alternative historians now, the revisionists, all have one thing in common. Their work is brilliant up to a point, and then it stops, and then it starts going straight back to the whole admiration bit of this Akhenaten, flying completely in the face of the facts.
Hmm.
Now, people will be saying, why am I talking about the Egyptian, you know, pharaohs when I'm talking about Ireland? Well, let's connect the dots then before the show finishes and just say this. In future shows, we'll be dealing more about the movement of the Irish and the whole Irish situation.
Yeah.
But for now, we'll just lay down the overview, which is that the whole of the unadulterated Egyptology, the true theocracy of Egypt, is Druidic in nature. There was a worldwide network of Druidic colleges that moved through Scandinavia, down into Germany, and into even Syria, and into Iran. The word Iran is Irish, by the way, because the Irish word for Ireland is Erin, E-R-I-N, Erin. It's still used today. Well, Erin is just a different pronunciation of Iran or Iran, Persia.
Yeah.
So, the Syrians, the Persians, the Iranians were subservient in theocracy to the Celts, the Celtic Druidic colleges. Can you believe this? What lies have been told to us down through society?
I got to ask you, Michael, of course, because in Iran today, they still have the Zoroastrian religion. Does this connect with the Akhenaten also, do you think?
It's a later version. If it does, it's a very later... what is Zoroastrianism? It's basically nothing but the worship of the sun.
Exactly.
Sura, or Zora, is a very ancient concept going back to Surya, or Sur, or Sir. That's why we call people Sir today, S-I-R.
Uh-huh.
They just put a Z on it. In India, they call it Surya, which means the sun. We call it, we say, Sir, do you have the time? Sir meant sun, meant the sun, literally in the heavens. S-I-R, or sire. When we said the sire, somebody sires a child. The whole idea was that, yes, like the sun, the father is the sun. And that used to be S-I-R, and then in Persian, Z-O-R, Zora, or Zura, Surya, is the sun. So Aster, by the way, Zoroaster, Aster is the word for the stars.
Yeah.
So it is a later rendition. It comes out of the cult of Mithras, and it is definitely a later version of the solar cult trying again to establish itself, but in a little bit later days. But its origins are surely, definitely, I agree with you, back in the time of the old stellar religion that was worldwide. And it spread to Egypt as well. We can accept that Roman culture grew out of Greek culture. There's not a historian in the world will ever deny that. Such assimilation can exist between two almost dissimilar places. That Roman culture exists because of Grecian culture. But as soon as you say that about any other place, they look at you as if you're talking utter nonsense.
Hmm. And do you think that, all this, because the only connection, as I see it, according to, what I pick up from your research and what you're saying here, is that the connection between Atlantis and the British Isles in Ireland is the connection to Atlantis.
Yes.
And is this the thing that they're most trying to hide?
Yes. This is okay. The most important, and I'm glad we have this established in the first show. So thanks for asking that question. This is also the reason why I did a book on Atlantis and Lemuria first. Before I got to the question of the Celts and the Irish and the Egyptians and all of these things that I've loved for years,
yeah.
My greatest passion has been to write on the occult history of Ireland and America. But you see, when I start laying down this research, I realize that you just can't jump in there because you haven't sketched in the background. So the Atlantis book was the sketch in the background before we get to the foreground, so that people understand the ancientness of civilization. Because it is extremely important, and I say this on almost every show, is let us be under no illusion that when we hear things even about New World Order and the world conspiracy, that this is not something new. This is something that is millennia old, except for the fact that we are now in the latter days of it.
Yeah.
We are living now in the fulfillment, conclusion era of something that is very, very old. I did the Atlantis book first, because what is the Atlantis book filled with? It's filled with the symbol of the serpent and the whole story of the serpent race, which originally, yes, was alien in nature, which came from another planet, possibly from, Alpha Draconis, from the star system Alpha Draconis. And the whole alien concept here of that it was alien beings, that the Nephilim, the fallen angels. And what you're talking about is exactly correct, because the Nephilim, one of their code terms was the sons of the serpent. That William Bramley calls the Brotherhood of the Snake, and that Lawrence Gardner has referred to as the Dragon Bloodline. And that's why even in Ireland today, how many, Scotland, Wales, and England, you see, don't they have dragons on their flags?
Yeah.
And the dragon is found on the Arthurian legends, you see. That's who they were. The dragon is the symbol of the ancient Atlantean knowledge. And of course, a lot of it was lost because Atlantis and Lemuria fell. These are lost continents of old. But the survivors and remnants came onto the lands that we know as Britain, specifically Ireland and Scotland. In Argyllshire and northwestern Scotland, which is very close to Scandinavia. You know, Bergen in Norway is one of the oldest cities in the world.
Hmm.
Well, you know, what do you think was going on there? They had an ancient Celtic church there years and years ago that the Christians have now built right on top of, hideously, trying to erase the fact that there was an ancient Aryan culture in Scandinavia at that time. So, yes, there was a dragon bloodline, and that's why it's so important. Now, in Egyptian concept, in the, I think it was the, 12, it was like at least 12 dynasties before Akhenaten. I'm talking about way back.
Yeah.
Was a dragon court that was run by a famous pharaoh that's known in occultism as Ankhof-Khonsu. He ran what was known as a dragon court in the earliest dynasties of Egypt. What I'm trying to make people understand is that that dragon court of the ancient dynasties of Egypt was an inheritance from the dragon courts of Ireland. That's why you have them in several places. And the dragon court of Ireland is a remnant of even a more ancient set of civilizations that finally now, through the work of Michael Cremo and Graham Hancock and other researchers, you see, we're able to discover absolutely factually existed. Because nobody listened to Erich von Däniken when he mentioned this.
Exactly.
Few people listened, you see, to Emanuel Velikovsky and to Charles Berlitz and, the other, and Ignatius Donnelly. They just said, no, that's not important. We're all very materialistic in the new millennium of the 20th century. And these scholars were just shunted aside, many of them suppressed. But now we got cameras. Now we got websites. Now we got DVDs. Graham Hancock is putting on a diver's suit, taking a camera down there, and literally filming it for you.
Exactly.
There's pyramids turning up in Bosnia. There's pyramids turning up in China that dwarf the pyramid in Giza.
It's everywhere.
It's everywhere. It cannot be refuted. Now, the thing is that we have not got an articulated history of the world because we have bought a lie.
Yeah.
There was those, remember those three famous taboo areas? You never question religion.
Yeah.
You never question the west to east, the east to west movement
yeah.
of civilization and so on. This is what my work goes straight to the heart of. Absolutely questioning religion. Absolutely questioning this lie that doesn't explain anything. This east to west movement. Of course there was migrations later on, but those migrations came after the time of Akhenaten, specifically at 677 B.C., when the so-called tribes of Israel were released from Assyria, and I'm not even saying I totally believe this story, but at least from a historical point of view, they say that there's enormous migrations of Judaic people from the 7th century, 6th century B.C., because there was tremendous drought. It may even be one of the reasons why the so-called chosen people were released from Assyria is because the land was hit by enormous droughts. And then there was these large migrations into the West. But the symbolism, the theocracy, the theology, the occultism, the magic, and the religion, and the customs that were brought by these migrating people from the East is of a much later date.
Yeah.
And when British Israelite henchmen, these are nothing but lieutenants of Vatican, the British Israelite movement, these are what we now would have spin doctors for a corporation or a political party, the British Israelite coterie, run by some very interesting scholars and powerful people, some of them geniuses in their own right, believe me. They're brilliant people to study.
Yeah.
Like Frederick Haberman and E. Raymond Capt. And a lot of people in this country have been reading them because some Christian pastors, unfortunately, deludedly, believe that what these people are talking about is actually right.
Hmm.
And this has become a problem. But the British Israelites really, if people read my work, they'll realize what this subject is all about. It's a spin doctor to explain why the great symbols of power, like the Star of David, came into the West. So when we find a Star of David on every seat in the Congress, when we find a fasci, an ancient symbol, on the back of the Congress room, and when we find a Star of David, no less, above an eagle and an Egyptian pyramid,
we should notice.
We better notice it. We have to find out, ask one simple question. Why is it that the American Stars and Stripes is shown as a shield in front of the eagle, which is the symbol of Aton, the symbol of Akhenaten, because the Akhenaten, the very word, means the eagle and the eye, by the way, as we said on the previous show. Now,
Michael, just let me break it. We got about 5 minutes left here.
Okay.
And I want to mention Because if we don't get anyone who call in today with the correct answer, we have a lot of listeners I know that are listening through the archives and are downloading this show. And I
yeah.
just want to mention that we will continue the contest that we begin here today. And you can simply send me a mail with the answer. And the first one that we receive with a correct answer, you know, will win. So simply mail to me at radio@redicecreations.com. Again, that's radio@redicecreations.com, and you'll still have the chance to win a DVD. So, Michael, why don't you go ahead and ask the question one more time for those who might have missed it.
Okay, yeah, the question is simply to tell us who the mother of Nefertiti is. Queen Nefertiti, the wife of Akhenaten, she had a mother, and we want to know her name. And that information is on my website. It's not that hard to find out, and that'll be great if people can, you know, later on at the archive, they still, the contest will be ongoing. And
yeah,
just make sure to actually give our accurate address.
Yeah. Yeah, of course, you know, we have about 3 minutes left, but, you know, I'm sorry to cut you off there, but...
No.
Where were we?
Well, I'd like to finish with something really important, which is thematic in nature. And it involves... You see, what we have to realize, first of all, is that not only are there many translations of every passage of the Bible, but the Bible was presented to the human race for the first time around the time of Henry VII in the 16th century.
Yeah.
So we're already talking about something that they say is 2,000 years old, but yet it was put in front of people very recently. And then when the first Bibles were put out there, they were chained to the altars so that no layman could ever examine them. First of all, you couldn't read Latin, so it was pointless. But anybody who even could read Latin, they couldn't take the Bible away from the altar because they were chained to the altars.
Yeah.
And when we realize that these religions, I don't care if it's Protestant or Catholicism or Islam or any other of the famous religions of the world, these have an origin. The secret societies have an origin. And that origin is Akhenaten and the 18th dynasty pharaohs of Egypt. These are the people who created the first solar church. You see, the natural order doesn't have a beginning. It doesn't have a date of birth, but God does. We create God.
Yeah.
God has a date of birth. You can actually go to temples in Egypt where they created God.
Oh, do we have a caller?
Yes, hello?
Yeah, hello, hi. What's your name and where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Sweden, Mr. Ross. This is Petri Anlin. I have been listening to Red Eyes quite a few weeks
great.
Now.
Can you hear him, Michael?
Yes, I can hear him.
Yeah, okay,
yes,
great.
Hello.
Great that you called in, Petri.
Yeah, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great
show.
Do you
have an answer?
Yes, my answer is great royal wife, Sitamon.
Yep, he's right.
That's right.
We have a winner. Congratulations.
We have a winner.
Yeah.
Excellent.
That's good, because I think I only mentioned that once or twice in the writing, so that's a well done to find that out. Sitamon, the great royal wife, and of course we'll be talking about her later on in the show, the importance of this particular personality. So well done.
Well done.
Thank you.
Great. And Peter, did you leave your address to Don?
Yes, I will mail my address and everything.
Yeah, you can mail. Sure. We have been corresponding before, so please go ahead.
Yes.
Perfect.
Yes.
Okay, Peter, do you like to ask Michael something before we end here?
No, I will just keep on listening.
Keep
it's very interesting.
Of course. Sure, man. Thanks for calling.
Okay. Okay, thanks.
Absolutely.
Yeah, talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Yeah, that's great. I hope that, Frederick, you enjoy the DVD.
Yeah.
But in closing, we definitely would like to say that the thing with these religions and the cult of God that these people have created does date from Akhenaten and from these Egyptian temples. And the idea to realize is this. This is what I have another personal peeve against, is that when you create a religion, and you create an idea of God being this very removed and isolated, you see, and distant force, then don't you already immediately then say that now you need a mediator between you and that force?
Yeah.
So this is also an important understanding, that when we're looking into the origins of secret societies, we're looking into the origins of religion, because religion and politics and secret societies are connected with this one philosophical idea.
Yeah.
Which is that,
Michael? I have to cut you off. I'm sorry, but we have to continue this next week. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, this has been great, and I'm looking forward to the part two of this. So,
absolutely, it's very inspiring. Thank you, Henrik, for your time, and we'll do it again real soon.
We will, and everybody listening, tune in live next Thursday, because we will have giving out a second DVD, and we'll have a new contest for you, and it's going to be great to continue this. So thank you, Michael, and thank you, everybody, for listening, and this has been Red Ice Radio. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye, everyone.